Everyone who's still with us, this is the last lecture of this mini-series, and this will connect to the topic that probably everyone of you is in one way or another interested in, and it's connected to your own research. So I will be talking about effective field theories about the electric scale, by which I mean I SMEFT, and I will also comment a little bit on an alternative to SMEFT. So for the first two lectures, I was taking you through this landscape of low energy effective field theories that were effective theories approximating different aspects of the standard model. And that was because this was a very nice playground to explain a lot of important concepts to about effective field theories. Now I'm gonna change gears, and I will be interested what happens at high energies at the scales where the standard model itself is no longer valid. So we have this ladder of EFTs. Yeah, in principle, yeah, it goes all the way up higher, although we don't know, maybe the standard model is the most fundamental theory. But we don't have really means to climb the ladder any higher, yeah, because they don't want to buy us another collider, yeah, and constructing, I mean, going to higher and higher energies becomes more and more difficult. On the other hand, what I'm going to argue is that we do have means to actually explore the high scales, and exactly by using the methods and tools of effective field theory. So this, let me start first with the standard model. So we have, this is the standard model Lagrangian, and this is the standard model particle content in a nice compact graph. So the Lagrangian is also very simple. You know that it fits the t-shirt. So if you buy the t-shirt, be sure to buy the one which has the correct normalization of the kinetic terms. Otherwise you will look stupid. And this standard model Lagrangian has 18 parameters, and so far, I mean, until now, all of them were measured with a very, very good precision. I think actually the least well measured parameters are related to the quark, light quark masses, but even those I think are now, thanks to their progress in the lattice, are now at the few percent level. So we know all the parameters of the standard model. This is like a complete theory. So this standard model has been extremely successful in describing all the collider experiments and low energy experiments. So we don't have any robust evidence that standard model doesn't work. That standard model doesn't work in this circumstance. So all the measurements we've done here on Earth, yeah, they only confirm the standard model or show some small deviations, yeah, that probably are some due to some of the experimental problems or are just the usual fluctuations that we expect. And on the other hand, we know for a fact that physics beyond the standard model exists. Yeah, that this is something that is probably has been stressed. You heard it many times, but let me just say the names again. We know neutrino masses exist, dark matter exists, inflation exists, and baryon asymmetry of the universe exists. And all of these four elements cannot be explained in the context of the standard model. We also have some theoretical hints that suggest that maybe we need an extension of the standard model, like the strong CP problem, flavor hierarchies, gauge coupling unification, and naturalness problems. But these are more peripheral. So this is like the additional arguments here, yeah, that we like to use. But these are based on the aesthetics, and they don't have to be true. But the first four arguments that are listed here, yeah, they are experimental facts that tell us that standard model has to be extended into a more fundamental theory. But at the same time, now we are in a bit in a crossroads. Yeah. So when I was a kid, yeah, so everybody knew that MSSM is true and will be discovered the LHC. And then there is, after MSSM, there is string theory, and one of these five string theories known at the time, it has to be the ultimate theory. Yeah. So Unfortunately, now we are in a different position. Yeah, we know that we don't know. We know that we know nothing. Yeah, and so there is many possible models that to explain this experimental facts or the theoretical aesthetical problems of the standard model. And I think it's fair to say at this time no single model or class of model is preferred. Yeah, and so for this reason we need some to search for new physics. We often prefer a model-independent approach, yeah, so as to keep an open mind on many possible forms of new physics that may show up in our experiment. So currently, the leading model-independent tool to parameterize the effects of new physics is effective field theory. There are other tools, yeah, people have been using them, but somehow EFT has become the leading tool, and this is for a reason, because all the other tools, they are some phenomenological proposals that are not actually theoretically consistent. The thing about the EFT is that they are self-consistent, they are systematically improvable. Yeah? So that's the important reason why EFT is the tool that is used to parameterize new physics. So in the EFT approach to physics beyond the standard model, what we do is that we assume that the particle spectrum that at the scales of interest, so that at some energy range above the electroweak scale, so is still the one of the standard model. There is no new particles that are entering here. Or if there is a new particle, it interacts so weakly that it will not affect our experiment. Yeah, so this is this loophole. Yeah, that is not weird. If there is some very very light weakly interacting particle, yeah, we don't care. But basically, the assumption is that there is no new particles. Yeah, at some energy range between the Z mass and the cutoff lambda. And for this to make sense, this cutoff lambda has to be at least a couple of TeV, yeah, otherwise this EFT description becomes a little bit difficult to justify. Now, so what we do, we write the Lagrangian of the EFT, is the Lagrangian of the standard model, which is the one that we know, and then all possible interactions that are not contained in the standard model, but all possible interaction between the standard model particles. And these are contained in this delta lambda BS. So far, so good. But as in any EFT, we have to choose some scheme to organize this Lagrangian. Otherwise, we have an infinite number of parameters and we are immediately lost. So we have to organize these interactions into some expansion that will tell us which of them are more important, which of them are less important, so which of them we should consider first, and which we can neglect in the first approximation. So in other words, we have to choose some power count. So there are two ways that this power counting is organized, and they go under the name linearly realized electroweak symmetry and nonlinear realized electroweak symmetry. And because these are long, very long words, I will use a shorter description. So if I talk about nonlinear, I will call it Heft. And if I talk about the linear realized electroweak symmetry, I will call it SMEFT. So it's this is the nomenclature that I'm adopting here. So in the SMEFT case, the organizing principle is that we say that the gauge symmetry of the standard model is valid and is realized linear in the sense that it acts on the Higgs field, yeah, as a linear transformation. So it acts in this way on the Higgs doublet, and and all the terms in the Lagrange that we write, they have to preserve the full SU3 cross SU2 cross U1 gauge symmetry. That's the scheme of the SMEFT. The scheme of the Heft is different. In this case, only part of the standard model gauge symmetry is realized in a manifest way. So we take the color SU3 and the electromagnetic U1 that is realized in a manifest way. And this, of course, has to be because this gauge symmetries that correspond to massless fields, we have no choice. Yeah, we have to keep them. But the part of the standard model gauge symmetry that is spontaneously broken is realized non-linearly. And it's realized in a way that is, this is borrowed from chiral perturbation theory. So effective theory of strong interactions of pions, yeah, that I wasn't talking about in my lectures, yeah, but it's probably very familiar to every one of you. So what you do in this case, yeah, you take the matrix field, the 2x2 matrix U, and you say that it's transformed so the SU2 transformations of the electric group act from the left. And then U1, they act as a matrix multiplication from the right. And this matrix will contain three Goldstone fields that are the Goldstone fields that are eaten by the gauge fields when they get masses. So, the relation between this matrix field and the Goldstone field is this, yeah, the U is equal to X of the Goldstone field. So now, you see why the name nonlinear, yeah? Because if you now rewrite this transformations, yeah, as a transformation of the Goldstone fields, you will find that the transformation of the Goldstone fields under electric symmetry will contain a linear and squared and cubic and so forth terms, yeah, that in terms of the Goldstone fields, yeah. So there will be a non-linear dependence, yeah, of the gauge transformations on the Goldstone fields. Very importantly, in this scheme, Higgs boson, who is just a singlet, it doesn't transform at all under the electric symmetry. So we have this three Goldstone fields that transform, and we have the Higgs fields the Higgs boson field that doesn't transform. And this is in contrast to what happens in SMEFT, where we have a Higgs doublet, and then both the Goldstone and the Higgs are on the same footing. They are part of the doublet that transform in a linear way under the electric symmetry. So just to give you an example, what this means in practice, yeah, is, let me take an example of the Higgs potential. In the Higgs potential, in the standard model, it's constructed out of two terms that are invariant under the standard model gauge symmetry. So we can write h squared and h to the fourth. Yeah. And this describes the Higgs mass and the Higgs self-interactions and the electric symmetry breaking and so forth. Now, if you want to deform it in the SMEFT scheme, what we can do, we can deform the potential by writing higher powers of the Higgs doublet field H. So we can write H to the 6, H to the 8, and so on. But this would be in some expansion in powers of 1 over lambda squared, where lambda is the cutoff of the theory that is supposedly large. So if we truncate this expansion, for example, at the first term of the squared, then we actually, you see that we only have one parameter that modifies the standard model Higgs potential. This is the C6. And from this parameter, all the corrections to the cubic term, to the quartic term, and to the new interactions with five Higgs boson fields and six Higgs boson fields, all these new corrections and the new interactions, they depend on this one parameter. Therefore, all these corrections will be correlated. So if we have a corrections to the Higgs cubic, then there will be a correlated corrections to the Higgs quartic, and then there will be a correlated interaction strength of five Higgses and six Higgses. So SMEFT will predict correlations between different couplings in the Lagrangian, in principle, in particular between the self-couplings of the Higgs boson. In Heft, it's completely different. In Heft, there is no correlations at all. The reason is simple. Higgs is a singlet in Heft. it doesn't transform under any gauge symmetries. So we can just write h cubed, h to the fourth vanished from here, sorry, h to the five, h to the six. So we can write any of these terms completely independently of each other. There is no symmetry that is connecting them. So each of them has its own Wilson coefficient that is independent of each other. So there is a very, very important difference between SMEFT and HEFT, and that SMEFT predicts correlations between different interaction. HEFT, in general, doesn't predict these correlations. Yeah, and the interactions of the Higgs field with different number of Higgs fields in particular are completely independent of each other. So this SMEFT and HEFT, they differ in about what they predict about the correlation in the between the parameters. So this looks like a benign maybe difference, but actually there is a more fundamental difference between the two that appears at the level that will become clear at the moment. So I will argue in the next few slides, yeah, that SMEFT and HEFT are very, very different theories with very different properties, and they actually correspond to a different class of UV completion. Namely, the SMEFT corresponds to BSM theories, where the masses of the heavy particles are depend on some parameter that can be taken to infinity, that can be as large as you want. On the other hand, HEFT corresponds to describes the so-called non-decoupling BSM theories, where the masses of the new particles vanish in the limit where you take electroweak symmetry breaking to zero. So the masses of the new particles are tied to the electroweak breaking scale. You cannot take them to infinity. They will always be proportional to this parameter V, which is 246 GeV. So they will always be of the order of the weak scale. They may be a little bit larger, but not much larger than the weak scale. So why am I saying this? Yeah, so this is something maybe that is not very well known, but it actually follows from a compact argument. So consider a toy model. So to see what's going on, consider a toy model of a heft. So we take the standard model and we add a cubic arbitrary cubic self-interaction of the Higgs. So we just deform only the cubic self-interaction of the Higgs, nothing else. So this is part of the HEFT parameter space, but this is not SMEFT, because in SMEFT, if you deform a cubic, as I was arguing a few slides ago, you also have to write down the quartic and the h to the 5 and to the h to the 6. I'm not writing it now, so I'm considering an example of the HEFT. So this is my potential that I'm considering. It has a mass term, it has the deformed cubic Higgs, and it has the standard model quartic Higgs. So this is something that probably a lot of people have, or maybe you have seen it used, especially in experimental analysis. There seems to be nothing wrong about it. Yeah, there's looks like a sort of even a renormalizable theory. However, there is something very interesting about this model, which you can see by using a trick, a theorist trick. So you see that in this potential, we work with the Higgs boson field, and the you don't see any electroweak symmetry, but actually, gauge symmetries, or especially spontaneously broken gauge symmetries, are not real things. Are only like our tools, yeah, of that we use to describe to write down our quantum field theories. So even though there is no electroweak symmetry, we can always introduce it like by hand. So if we replace the Higgs field by square root of 2h dagger h minus v, then this thing in the unitary gauge, yeah, will be equal. So this expression on the right hand side in the unitary gauge, if you just plug in this expression, will be exactly h. So there is no difference. So I can always replace the Higgs with this expression. So now instead of the potential that depends on the Higgs boson field. We have a potential that depends on the Higgs doublet, and it has this funny squid. I mean, it's completely okay, except that it has this funny square root here. So in the unitary gauge, again, I say this potential and this potential are the same. And since physics is independent of the gauge, it means that these two, the theories with this potential, a theory with this potential, and the theory with this potential are exactly the same. They describe exactly the same physics. If there is some questions, if something is unclear, please don't hesitate to ask, and I'll be happy to stop this, to pause at any moment. So, but the point is that I was using this trick is that in this form, you can actually see what is going wrong with this potential. So because we have this square root, even though in the unitary gauge, you see only normal Higgs interaction, h cubed and h to the fourth, if you go beyond the unitary gauge, so if you now put the full Higgs doublet here, that then there is something funny going on, because now you have an interaction, with that this is square root of h plus v squared plus g squared. So you can expand it. For example, we expand it in the powers of g squared, so we are interested in the extracting from that interaction of with two Goldstone bosons. So if we extract this, if we expand the square root to the first order in g squared, we'll get this term g squared a squared over h plus v. So we just take out h plus v in front and then expand the usual Taylor expansion of the square root, and this is what you get here. And then we can do a Taylor expansion or using the geometric series of this, and it means that this kind of interaction with the square root is actually equivalent to an interaction of two Goldstone bosons with an arbitrary number of the Higgs fields. So because we had 1 over h plus v here, so it's actually g squared h, g squared h squared, g squared h cubed, g squared h fourth, and so on all the way to infinity. So outside of the unitary gauge, you're getting this contact interaction between the Goldstone and the Higgs bosons. Now, why this is wrong? It's wrong because by equivalence theorem, the amplitude with the Goldstone boson and amplitudes with the gauge bosons, or with more precisely with longitudinally polarized gauge bosons, have to be equal at high energies. So now if I calculate the amplitude for scattering of two Goldstone bosons into n Higgs bosons, where n is arbitrary, I'm getting from this interaction, I'm getting this formula. So we have this contact vertex with two G's and n H's, and then we're getting an amplitude that has this form. What is actually not right about this amplitude is that it's not suppressed by any powers of energy. It's just a number that it's only suppressed by powers of the electroweak scale, but there is no dependence on energy. And this is wrong because this violates unitarity. So to understand why it violates unitarity, let's just make a quick go back to school session. So just two slides about the unitarity in quantum field theory. So You probably heard it many times that from this equation S dagger S equals 1 from the S matrix unitarity, you can derive these equations for the amplitudes that relates the imaginary part of the amplitude to the square of the amplitude. So I split on the right hand side the an elastic contribution to the square of the amplitude, so with 2 to 2 processes, and then 2 to n processes. So basically on the right hand side you have to sum over all possible final states of this 2 to 2 amplitude. So this is the equation, so if you now you can project it into the partial waves, so somehow to in the space of partial waves this equation diagonalizes so that it gets a simpler form like this that connects the imaginary part of the Elf partial wave to the squared of the Elf partial wave plus this inelastic part that comes from here. So this is an equation of a circle. You can rewrite this as an equation of a circle. So if you write a squared as the real part of a squared plus imaginary part of a squared, you can rewrite this this equation, the same equation as an equation for the circle. So real part squared plus imaginary part minus one squared is equal to the radius squared, where the radius is one minus this inelastic part. So in the quantum field theory, I mean, if you, in the 60s, yeah, people were discussing this. Yeah, this is called, in this old language, this is called the Argand circle. And it means that, yeah, there's the amplitudes should lie on this Argand circle so that the theory is unitary. So in particular, it means that because the radius of this circle is always at most one, if inelastic channels are zero, then it means that this real part of the amplitude of the Elf partial wave has to be less than one. And this is the unitarity equation that you probably used at some point in your life, for example, maybe to justify the existence of the Higgs boson from the WW scattering amplitude. But there is another unitarity equation that follows from this that is often forgotten. It means that the inelastic part cannot be larger than one. Because if you switch on the inelastic part, you shrink the radius of the Argand circle. And if you shrink it too much, there is no circle on which the amplitude can be can live. And then again, the theory is no longer unitary. So you have this constraint from unitarity that the integral over the phase space, over sum of the integrals of the over all phase space of all inelastic channels has to be less than one. What does it mean for our problem? Yeah, so in this case, yeah, we calculated the Goldstone amplitude into n Higgses, and if you now take the square of it, yeah, and integrate over the phase space and sum over all possible final states with n Higgses, so with two Higgses, three Higgses, four Higgses, then this has to be less than one. But because this amplitude was just a number independent of energy, actually this integral is sort of trivial, it's just the volume of the phase space. And for the volume of the phase space, you can find the formula in the literature. But what is really important is that it's proportional, so the volume of the phase space grows with energy. Because the more energy you have, the more phase space you have. And the growth of the energy you can just find from dimensional arguments that this volume of the phase space grows as S, where S is the square root of S is the center of mass energy. So then the volume of the phase space grows as N to the power of N minus 2. So for 2 to 2 scattering, when N equals 2, the volume of the phase space doesn't grow with energy. We only have angular variables. But once you go to 3 and 4 and 5, then the volume of the phase space grows with energy, and the faster it grows, the larger is the n. So you see that if, in order for the theory to remain unitary, if this has to be less than one, then amplitude has to decay with energy for larger n. So that for the 2 to 3 amplitude, for example, it's not enough to be constant at high energies to maintain unitarity. It has to actually go like 1 over square root of s, so that the square of it goes like 1 over s, to cancel the growth of the phase space, and so on. So 2 to 4 has to go like 1 over s, and 2 to 5 has to go like 1 over s to the 3 half, and so on. Otherwise, the theory violates unitarity. So the unitarity equation is here. Again, I write it here. So again, this is the volume of the phase space that grows like s to the power of n minus 2. This is our amplitude, which we estimated. Yeah, it's proportional to this cubic deformation. There is some factorials of n, and there is 1 over v to the n in the denominator. And so now we plug it in. So this has to be less than 1. we plug in the volume, which goes like s to the power of n minus 2, and then there is this, again, factorial factors. There is, we plug in the square of the amplitude, and then it turns out that because these factorials cancel, there is 1 over n factorial from identical particles in the phase space, it actually this exponentiates. Yeah, so you can write this whole thing, you can approximate it by exponential of s over 4 pi v squared and something proportional to this deformation. So what does it mean? And this has to be less than 1. So somehow exponential of energy over 4 pi v squared has to be less than 1. Of course, that cannot happen if s is large. So even if that, if this deformation is small, if you take this deformation to be 0.1 or 0.01, as soon as you go over the scale 4 pi v, this exponential grows, like exponential, it grows exponentially, and immediately you violate this unitarity condition. So the cutoff of this theory was this cubic deformation a la Heft has to be 4 pi v times a factor that is always of order 1. It cannot be much larger unless you make this deformation like 10 to minus 20 or something. Yeah, then you can actually change this conclusion. But unless this deformation is something that is observable in practice, then the cutoff of the theory is at 4 pi v. You cannot go to higher energies within this theory. It means that, and this is actually general thing about the Heft. In the Heft, you always, your cutoff is at 4 pi v. You cannot extend your Heft. It cannot be valid above the energies of order 4 pi v. This is in contrast to the Smith, where it can be valid to all the way to the cutoff lambda, and lambda is arbitrary, is anywhere between TV and the Planck scale. So that is the huge difference between the Smith and Heft. Yeah, that one of them always breaks down at near the electroweak scale at 3 TeV, and the other can be valid to describe physics at very, very high scale. So if to conclude this discussion, yeah, so if you have an EFT with a nonlinear realized electroweak symmetry, so if you have Heft, then it's always losing its validity region is always below the scale 4 pi v, which is of the order of 3 t. That it means that Heft is useful to approximate BSM theories which live right above the electroweak scale. Yeah, you cannot approximate the theories, for example, that live at the 10 TeV or 100 TeV or so on. If you have your new particles at higher scales, Heft is completely useless. It actually, you can show something because of this non-analytic potential that appears in the Heft. You can show that it corresponds to integrating out particles whose masses depend on the electroweak scale itself. So if you take for example, standard model plus fourth generation of chiral fermions, this fourth generation will have masses that are proportional to V. And if you integrate them out, you'll get a Heft. This is what Heft describes. Theories, yeah, which are where new particles are get the masses from electroweak breaking. They don't have their own masses. So Faiz, there was a question, please.
Yeah, a simple question. I mean, we usually use Heft and Smift in order to predict the scale of new physics at UV. And if Heft is not extrapolated beyond 3 TeV as it should, does that mean that it's like completely useless because we don't find any new physics below the 3 TeV in the LHC?
Yeah, that is maybe too strong conclusion. That is because, morally, yes. Yeah. So Heft, currently the applications of Heft are very limited because it's difficult to find a model that is where new particles get their masses from electroweak breaking. and which is not yet excluded. For example, fourth generation of chiral fermions, the example I gave here, is excluded by hundreds of sigma, just from the measurements of the Higgs couplings. So that is not a viable model of new physics. I wouldn't go that far as to say that you cannot construct a model for which the heft would not be excluded and for which would have to be a valid description. But it's certainly not easy. Okay, on the other hand, SMEFT corresponds is a description, is an effective description of BSM, where new particles, they have their own masses that are independent of the electroweak scale. And the example that we know, for example, the example that we know from experience, is, for example, standard model plus vector-like fermions. Vector-like fermions are the fermions that have both the light, they are not chiral, and you can write down a mass term for them, which is independent of electroweak breaking. So if you have a theory with vector-like fermions, the masses, they depend on some free parameter, this vector-like mass, that can be anything between some electroweak scale, or you can take it to 10 TeV, 100 TeV, whatever you want. And then if this mass of the new particles is not tied to the electroweak scale, then the effective description of that BSM would be SMEFT and not HEFT. So, in a different words, HEFT describes non-decoupling new physics, and SMEFT describes decoupling new physics. So, for the rest of this lecture, I will forget about HEFT, and I will focus on the SMEFT. And I will discuss a few salient features of the SMEFT here. If there's no more question about this last discussion, HEFT versus SMEFT, let me go to SMEFT.
I might have a question, Adam, if I can. Probably very naive, but so I understand the distinction that you have done, but with SMEFT, can I also describe the theories which are decoupled or not at all?
So that's the point. You can describe the theory that you are decoupled in a sense that the masses of the new particles are at very, very large scale. Then you will have a SMEFT where the operators will be suppressed by some very high scale.
So in a sense, as of today, in fact, SMEFT is a more complete approach because it also includes the theory that you could describe eventually with EFT. So is it correct?
No, I don't think I understood it. So it's the other way around. The parameter of space of HEFT contains SMEFT. But of course, if you are at this point of the parameters, so HEFT is something more general. And for that reason, people people sometimes try to use HEFT to describe new physics in a more general way. But then there is a price, that once you go away from this parameter space of that corresponds to SMEFT, once you go away from that, your theory explodes at the scale 4 pi v, at the scale of 3t. So there is a price for that.
Okay. Thanks.
Good. Okay. So in the last 20 minutes of this lecture, I want to talk about SMEFT. I want to talk about some features of SMEFT that are important for phenomenology. So the way we build SMEFT, as we say, we write the standard model Lagrangian, and then we say that this theory is valid. I mean, that the particle content of the standard model remains the only degrees of freedom up to some scale lambda, and then we expand this theory in 1/lambda, where each term has canonical dimension that is such that the dimensions agree. So for example, if you have 1/lambda here, then you need to write the dimension 5 of terms, 1/lambda squared dimension 6 terms, and so on all the way to infinity. And of course, you choose at which point you truncate this expansion. You can go all the way to very large terms. But because we expect that this lambda is large, it's much larger than TeV. That's what it seems from the both LHC and precision measurements. Then this means that only the first, typically the first two terms in this expansion are really relevant, and for the rest we can forget about. So even though this expansion is formally infinite, and for practical purpose we can truncate this expansion at d equals 6, yeah, and without losing any important effects. Okay, so let's start with the first term, which is dimension 5. At dimension 5, it's actually the situation is very simple. Please, Sufais.
Oh, yeah, thank you. Probably asked this before, just want to know it in Smift. Now, how do we know that we have only one scale of new physics to expand?
We don't. Yeah. So I will comment it about it just in a moment, actually. Yeah. So we don't. Yeah. So this is an assumption, and actually we'll be forced to modify this assumption in a moment. So just bear with me. Okay. So let's start with the dimension 5. So at dimension 5, the situation is very simple because there is only one way we can take the standard model field, and without violating gauge invariance or Lorentz invariance, the only way we can write the dimension 5 term is this way. So write LH times LH, where L is the lepton doublet field, so it contains neutrino and the left-handed electron, and H is the Higgs doublet, which in the unitary gauge is just a VEF in the second component. And this, so remember that this contraction, yes, via epsilon, so upper multiplies the lower here, and the lower multiplies the upper. That is the way that you have to contract, yeah, to again to make it gauge invariant. And this term then will lead to neutrino masses, yeah, because this Higgs VEF will hit the neutrino component of the double. So this dimension 5 terms, they will lead to Majorana neutrino masses. So this operator is sometimes called the Weinberg operator, but you have to be careful because there is probably 10 or more things in quantum field theory that are called Weinberg operators. Yeah, there is, so it's not, be careful when you use this name not to confuse it, yeah, with dozen of other Weinberg operators. And they break the lepton. The characteristic thing is that they break the lepton number. Yeah, so neutrino, Majorana masses of neutrino, they break the lepton number because neutrino have a lepton number plus one, and then you multiply the same field. Yeah, there's no bar here. You multiply the same field, and this has the this term carries the lepton number equals to minus two. So the thing is that, so this is actually interesting, yeah, because we know that neutrino masses exist, and theoretically, most likely, they are of the Majorana type. Yeah, so there is, of course, still this possibility that might never be excluded, that neutrino masses are of the Dirac type, but theoretically, the Dirac type is much more, it's much more, much less likely, yeah, much, because if you have a right-handed neutrino, you can always write the Majorana term without breaking any symmetries. Yeah, so unless the lepton number, yeah, is a fundamental symmetry of nature, yeah, then it's unlikely that the Dirac we have Dirac neutrinos. Yeah, so this is probably really this term really exists. So this is a huge success of the Smith, actually. Yeah, so we it's maybe not stressed enough, but look, we actually use this EFT rules to construct an effective theory. We write the standard model, and then we write the first non-trivial order of this effective field theory, and then lo and behold, we find this prediction realized in nature. Yeah, that this dimension, this lowest order term in the expansion of the SMEFT beyond the standard model, is indeed realized in nature and has been observed in experiment. So this is a huge success of the SMEFT approach. However, there is an issue, yeah, that now I connect to the question by Fayez here, yeah, is that actually this scale that enters here must be very, very large. So if we assume that this Wilson coefficient C, this parameter C, are of the order of 1, we know that neutrino masses are of the order of 10 to minus 1, 10 to minus 2 eV. Yeah? So we don't know them exactly. Yeah? This is like one of the most shameful aspects, yeah, of the current particle physics, that we don't know the neutrino masses. We only know the neutrino mass difference squared. Yeah? So it is possible, yeah, that these neutrino masses are maybe a bit larger, maybe like 1 eV, but then they cannot be much larger than 1 eV because some other constraints. So all in all, this scale has to be very large in order to, so that V squared over lambda is equal to 10 to minus 1 eV, and V is almost eV, yeah, then it means that the scale has to be huge, of the order of 10 to 15 GeV. So now if we actually stick to our original assumption, yeah, that there is one scale of new physics, that we have to expand the Lagrangian in this scale, 1 over lambda squared, then this dimension 6 terms are suppressed by the square of this of this lambda. So they are hugely suppressed and they are not observable for any practical purpose, maybe except the baryon number violating operators that live in this dimension 6. So if this were true, basically we would have to finish particle physics now. Yeah, it might be true. It might be true that this is the expansion parameter of the SMEFT, and then that the only experiments that are worth doing now are the ones with proton decay. So we should all switch and do proton decay, and all the other experiments, they don't make sense. But of course, for practical reasons, we don't want to accept the conclusions like that. Even though it might be suggested by nature, we don't accept it. So now we modify our original assumption. There is not, we don't say that there is one scale of new physics. We say that there is two scales of new physics. Of course, yeah, and there might be more, yeah, but let's start with this assumption, yeah, that there is two scales of new physics. One we continue calling lambda, and the other we'll call lambda L. And the point is that this dimension 5 operator are special because they violate the Lapton number. So maybe the scale of new physics that violates the Lapton number is much, much larger. We call it lambda L. It's 10 to 15 GeV, let's say. And then there is another scale of new physics that, however, conserves Lapton number, so cannot contribute to this dimension 5 terms. However, it can contribute to dimension 6 terms. So maybe the expansion of the SMEFT is this. And that's what will be our assumption in the following, that there is one scale, lambda L, big scale that corresponds to dimension 5 and dimension 7 and any odd dimension operators, because these are the ones that violate the Lapton number. And then there is another scale that is much smaller, that is reachable in experiment, that corresponds to the to that suppresses dimension 6 and dimension 8 terms and so on. So this is the assumption that we adopt in the following. Okay, now once we get to dimension 6, yeah, there's of course all hell breaks loose. Yeah, so dimension 5 was simple, there was only one class of operators. In dimension 6, yeah, you have this humongous numbers of operators and different effects that you have to consider. So let me walk you through what kind of effects that you have to pay attention to. There's basically two kinds of people, not people, but two kinds of effects. There is one kind of effect is there are this dimension 6 operator will bring new interactions that are not present in the standard model Lagrangian. Or the second kind of effect is that there is this dimension 6 operator might correct the interaction strength of interactions that are already present in the standard model. So what I mean by that, so for example, new interactions would be a new vertex that is absent in the standard model. And their very simple example is we take a dimension 6 operator h to the 6, and then it produces the vertices with 6 Higgses and 5 Higgses, which are not present in the standard model. So dimension 6 produces new kinds of interactions. In particular, these new kinds of interactions might violate the global symmetries of the standard model. And the one example of that is the operators violating baryon number that also arise at dimension 6. So for example, we can take the right-handed up and down quarks, and we can construct this kind of operator, yeah, that will contribute to proton decay. The other kind of new interactions is that new Lorentz structures appear in interactions that were not present in the standard model. An example is the following, which let's take a dimension six operator, H squared, W mu, where this is the field strength of the SU2 gauge bosons. So if you now, after electric symmetry breaking, this will produce interaction of the Higgs boson with this field strength of the W bosons. So this is so interaction of H with two W's does exist in the standard model. This is this interaction that is proportional to the mass of the W boson, but it has no derivatives in the standard model. So this means that we don't modify the vertex remains Higgs with two W bosons, but the Lorentz structure of this vertex now changes. Yeah, instead of just having eta mu nu here in this from this vertex, here we have something that depends on the momenta of the W bosons. In particular, an example of changing the Lorentz structure, there is a class of operators that introduce the Lorentz structure that violates CP. And one example is this interaction of three gauge bosons. This is again dimension six operators. By the way, yeah, so when I was talking about the Euler Heisenberg Lagrangian, I was saying that there is no interaction with three photons. However, with three SU2 gauge bosons, you can write down an interaction just because you have also this epsilon tensor and this W's, they have an index, yeah, that can be different. Yeah, so you cannot write this kind of interaction if all the W's are the same, but now they are different because this has index one, this has index two, and this has index three. And this leads to an interaction between the W bosons and the photons that violates, I forgot to put the tilde here in this operator. So imagine that there is a tilde above this last one, and then this operator violates CP. Of course, the one without tilde also exists, but maybe it's less interesting for this discussion. So if there is a tilde, then there's also a tilde here, and this interaction will violate the CP symmetry that is approximately conserved in the standard model. What about modified interaction strands? So there is actually three ways the interaction strands the standard model can be modified by higher dimensional operators. There is directly, indirectly, or something that are called stealthily. So let me go through these three examples. So the direct way is when we have a dimension six operator contributing to directly changing the interaction strength of gauge interactions or of Yukawa interactions. An example is this operator. Again, this is dimension six operator. We have two right-handed electrons, and then we have this combination of the Higgs fields. And if you evaluate this combination after electric symmetry breaking, you see that it has a term proportional to the Z boson. That then, after electric symmetry breaking, this operator will lead to a new interaction of the Z boson between the Z boson and right-handed electrons. Now, this kind of interactions already exist in the standard model. In the standard model, Z boson interacts with fermions according to their isospin and charge, and this is the Weinberg angle. However, dimension six operator will change this. Yes, so no, the interaction no longer will have to be given, be set by these quantum numbers, but can receive an arbitrary corrections. And in this case, this correction is proportional to this Wilson coefficients CHE and V squared over lambda squared, yeah, the electroid scale over the scale lambda of the EFT. So this is a correction, yeah, that then you can measure, for example, in the using the LEP1 Z pole data, and this is the pole data, and you can constrain this Wilson coefficients using this data. And another way that you can get a correction to the interaction is when the operator modifies the kinetic term of a standard model field. An example is this operator. So this is, I call it CH box, H dagger H, D'Alembertian H dagger H. And then you can take one derivative like here, then you break electric symmetry, and then it leads to, you can convince yourself that it leads to, among other terms, to a contribution to the kinetic term of the Higgs boson proportional to this Wilson coefficient CH box. So in quantum field theory, it's usually easier to work with canonically normalized kinetic terms. So what we have to do, we have to rescale our Higgs boson field so as to get rid of this correction. So if we, in the standard model, we have this kinetic term, after this rescaling, we will produce an opposite an opposite effect, and this will give us the, so we can, after this rescaling, yeah, we can get rid of this of this correction from that comes from the higher dimensional operator. However, once you do that, once you do this rescaling, then all the interaction of the Higgs boson will also get rescaled. So Higgs interacts with the W bosons and Z bosons in the standard model, and then it will all get rescaled by the same factor. So all the standard model interactions, yeah, will of the Higgs boson with matter will get rescaled and will change value. And then by using the, for example, the LHC data, you can put the constraints on this on this Wilson coefficient. Let me go through the last thing. This will be the last thing. I will talk about today in this lectures. Yeah, because we are running out of time. But let me finish with this example. So this is the example of a stealth contribution to standard model interactions. So consider this operator H dagger d mu H squared. This is again a dimension six operator. After we multiply it by some arbitrary Wilson coefficients, and after electric symmetry breaking, you find that it will produce a contribution to the Z boson mass. So after taking into account this operator, the Z boson mass will have the expression for the Z boson mass will be this. This is the first part. This one is the contribution from the standard model, the well-known expression for the Z boson mass in the standard model. And then there will be a correction from this dimension six operator. So what you wanna do now is to constrain this Wilson coefficient. So you take the very precise measurement of the Z boson mass from PDG, and then you find that this correction, yeah, to the Z boson mass cannot be larger than this value, 1 over 2060 eV squared. So this is what you could do. But that, of course, would be very, very wrong. If you do that, yeah, then you're making a big, big mistake, and this would be a wrong constraint. And actually, this kind of, from time to time, I'm stressing in this, because from time to time you find in the literature this kind of discussion, and leading to wrong conclusions. And this can be a very, very, very wrong conclusion. Why can't we do that? The reason is that the Z boson mass is used in the standard model to determine the electroweak parameters. So in the standard model, we have these three parameters, yeah, that in the Lagrangian, which is the SU2 gauge coupling, GL, hypercharge gauge coupling, GY, and the Higgs VEF, V. So we don't know them. There is no holy book which tells us the value of these parameters. We have to get them from experiment. So in the standard model, we get them most often from the Fermi constant, from the measurement of the Fermi constant that is related to this, to the Higgs VEF, from measurement of alpha that is related to the gauge couplings, and from measurement of Z boson mass, which is related to both the gauge coupling and the Higgs VEF. So we have three observables and three parameters, so we can find their numerical values. But now what happens is that after taking into account these dimension six operators, the expression for these input parameters are deformed, and we no longer can solve this from these three observables. We can no longer find the values of the electroweak parameters, because now the right hand side here depends on the CHD, so we have four parameters and three observables. So what could I do? Yeah, so of course we cannot use the Z boson mass to constrain CHD, because at this point we don't know the values of the electroweak parameters. What you could do is to add another observable, for example W mass, and then you would have four observables and you get from this four parameters. But of course this would be very inefficient, yeah, because then you add another Wilson coefficient, yeah, to your game, and then you have more parameters and you have to add more observables and so on. So it would be a little bit awkward to do it. So there is a very nice trick that allows you to get rid of this pollution. You can rescale your electroweak parameters so as to get rid of this piece in the input observables. And in this case, the correct rescaling is this. I mean, this is easy to check in a one page, half a page of algebra, yeah, that if you rescale the SU2 coupling like that and the SU and the U1 coupling like that, then this will add up here to cancel this term. On the other hand, it will not change this two rescalings are correlated such so as to not change anything here. And of course here nothing is changed because it only depends on V. So after this rescaling, in terms of this new Twiddle coupling, the expression for the input observables is the same as in the standard model, except that now these are not the original couplings, but these Twiddle couplings. And now we can solve them, and now we can assign numerical values, the same as in the standard model, of course, to these Twiddle couplings, GL and GY. So, however, it doesn't mean that the effect of this operator vanishes. It means that it actually goes somewhere else, because once we rescale this gauge couplings, this effect of the Wilson coefficient CHD will pop up all over the place in basically in every observable that depends on the gauge coupling, in particular on the W mass. In the W mass is given in the standard model by this expression, GL of V over 2. And there is this operator that we consider doesn't contribute to the W mass. However, once you do the rescaling into the Twiddle parameter, this CHD will pop up in the expression for the W mass. So actually, to constrain this operator, this Wilson coefficients, we cannot use the Z mass, but we can use some other observable that is not an input observable, for example, W mass. Of course, we can use many, many other observables that will give us similarly strong bound, or the best, we should make a global fit, yeah, and we should constrain it from a global fit. But taking this, the W mass measurement from the from PDG, and also taking the standard model prediction for that measurement, you can find this constraint on the Wilson coefficient that is very different than what you would obtain from the Z boson mass. Yes, you would make a huge mistake. Yeah, if you try to constrain the CHD from the Z boson mass, but the correct constraint comes from the W boson mass, for example. So this is something very, very important to remember, yeah, that there is this effect in the SMEFT on the input observables that affects interaction strengths in a very stealthy way, but it has to be taken into account to correctly evaluate the constraints on the Wilson coefficients using the using the experimental data. And I mean, in the electroweak physics, that this is done correctly most of the times. However, for example, in flavor physics, we have the same problem. Yeah? So in flavor physics, we have these parameters of the CKM matrix, which we can choose as lambda A rho at eta, which are related in a well-known way to the CKM element V. So again, this parameters, they're not God given. Yeah, so you can try to open PDG and find the value of lambda, for example, of the Khabibov angle. But this value of the Khabibov angle will be affected by the measurements that are used to extract the Khabibov angle are affected by new physics, which is not taken into account in these fits that find the CKM parameters, because these fits are done always under assumption of the standard model. So you cannot take the value of the CKM parameters from the books and then do your flavor physics constraints on other operators. You have to be careful to actually take into account that new physics might pollute this measurements of this CKM parameters. And then you could adopt some, for example, some input scheme which allows you to again redefine away, like in electroweak physics, this effects of new physics and find assign numerical values to a Tweedle version of the CKM parameters. Yeah, so this is something that can be done, but actually in flavor physics is not done. And sometimes this can be, this effects can be neglected. Sometimes they lead to wrong, very wrong results. So let me finish this. I had a few more slides, but I think that this is time to stop because I'm already over time. So I'll just stop thanking you for getting all the way to here. And if there is more question, please.